Hello and welcome to Savouring Change, a podcast by the Brighton and Hove Food Partnership, where we highlight the people and projects that are using food to bring about positive change for individuals and for our cities. We dig into the main issues that we work with every day as a food partnership, unpicking some of the complexity around food and exploring in more depth why it's such an important issue for our cities. In this episode, you're joined by me, Ruth Smart, and my colleague, Laura Hockenhull, as we speak to a local tenant downland farmer, Ed Brown, about his experience of conservation grazing. That is, using goats, cows and sheep to graze and maintain the delicate and incredibly biodiverse chalk grassland surrounding our city and much of the South Downs. And later, bringing them into the local food system as locally reared and slaughtered livestock. Ed is one of the farmers we work with as part of our Sussex Graze scheme, which aims to increase the amount of high welfare and locally grazed livestock that enters Brighton and Hove and the surrounding areas. This conversation took place at Clapham Farm, where Ed and his multi-generational farming family are based, near Littlington. This chat is interdispersed with snippets from a conversation I had with Sophie Robinson, who is the project manager of the Land Use Plus project, within which Sussex Graze sits. This project is all about developing a long-term plan for sustaining the chalk grasslands surrounding Brighton and Hove, of which conservation farming and Sussex Grazed all play a role. At its core, this is a conversation about the complex intersections of farming, heritage and sustainability, and we attempt to give an insight into what it actually looks like to balance conservation grazing with livestock rearing in today's globalised food system. Ed, can you describe where we're stood and what we're looking at?
So we are at the moment looking over the Cookmere Valley towards the White Horse. So we own Clapham Farm and then tenant farm Frogfell Farm with the National Trust. And that's where we're turning the ewes and lambs out at the moment. So lamb at Clapham and then turn out up on top of Hindover, which is just outside Seaford. And what we're looking at the moment is the White Horse.
So my name is Sophie and I'm the project manager for Land Use Plus, which is an initiative started by Brighton and Hove Food Partnership to support the delivery of the City Downland Estate Plan. Brighton and Hove City Council own about 13,000 acres of land up in the South Downs, and 74% of this is farmland. The council wants to deliver nature-friendly farming across that land in partnership with their tenant farmers. And the Land Use Plus project is designed to help them deliver this whilst also creating robust local food systems. An example of which is Sussex Grazed. Sussex Grazed is a meat box scheme which works with conservation graziers to bring responsibly raised meat to local people as part of the Changing Chalk project. Now, Changing Chalk is a partnership of organisations which is led by the National Trust, and the idea of the partnership is to connect nature, people, heritage, whilst restoring lost landscapes, particularly chalk grassland and its associated habitats, whilst bringing history to life and offering new experiences.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's going on here on the farm? We've just had a really nice wander around the farmyard and seen some nice little lammies and some cattle, but do you want to tell us, what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, so Clapham Farm is a sort of a completely mixed farming business. So we've got cattle, sheep, arable, and then some goats kicking about. Clapham Farm is sort of the home family farm, and then we're also tenant farmers at the National Trust at Frogfell Farm and Gales Farm, or great grazers up at Gales Farm. And it's an entirely mixed farming business where each enterprise sort of feeds into the other. And right now it's the middle of lambing, or our first flock lambing, so coming towards the end of February. And our first flock lamb between the 14th, so Valentine's Day, so a nice way to spend your Valentine's Day is lambs popping out in the middle of the night. And they lamb for 3 weeks, finishing the first week of March. And then our second flock lamb in April. And that's where we keep our replacement stock from. And calving's just about to kick off, so it's a busy time of the year. And it's been raining non-stop as it's just started raining again outside.
Yeah, so I know a little bit about the farming here from the Sussex Grays project and our meat box scheme, but for the benefit of Ruth from Savouring Change and for our Brighton Hoof Food Partnership listeners, do you want to tell us a little bit about your family and like the history of farming in your family?
Yeah, so Brown family have been farming at Clapham since 1921, and before then the family was based in Wiltshire, farming there, so it's sort of always been sort of farming in the blood. Mum and dad both from farming families. Dad obviously Clapham farm, and mum's family farmer is over just outside Shoreham, on Truleigh Hill. And yeah, I mean, farming has always been part of the family and part of what we do. And it's sort of it's the life that you sort of choose. I guess it was sort of half thrust upon you, half you choose it. And it's great, and everyone sort of has a very sort of similar feeling of extensive farming and sort of mixed farming is what we love doing, and working with the landscape and on a nice summer's day, there's no better place to be than up on the downs.
Well, quite a lot of definitions as to what nature-friendly farming is. A catch-all term for it is probably agroecological, and people interpret this in lots of different ways and perform it in lots of different ways. The long and the short of it is working with natural systems and growing with nature. This often takes the form of mixed farming, which involves animals fertilising land and grazing down crops, as opposed to using chemical fertilisers and herbicides to do those jobs. Listening to that, that might sound like quite an old-fashioned way of farming, and that's probably because it is, really. It's sort of how we farmed in the UK up until the end of the Second World War, when there was a massive drive for mass production and increased availability of agricultural chemicals. Until this point, much of the UK was grassland, which was ploughed up and improved with chemical fertilisers in order to increase yield. And that, over time, has led to the loss of 97% of our grasslands across the UK in less than 80 years. One of the most notable examples of which is chalk grassland, which we do still see fragments of around Brighton to this day. So chalk grassland is incredibly biodiverse. In fact, it's often known as the European rainforest. It's actually one of the most biodiverse habitats that exists in the world. Not that you would really know it from looking at it. What it actually looks like is a sort of nasty kind of looking shabby grassland. It certainly doesn't look as special as it is. The reality is it supports a huge variety of flowers and plants and grasses, like the Pride of Sussex or the Round-Headed Rampion. Within all of that lives all of these amazing insects, reptiles, snails, bees, and it's just full of incredible biodiversity. It might not look like much, but it certainly smells amazing, it sounds amazing, and in the past we would have had enormous swathes going all across the Eastern Downs. People like Rudyard Kipling and Virginia Woolf used to come down to Sussex to enjoy chalk grassland and were inspired to write about this unique landscape.
So across the three farms that we manage, so Clapham, Frogfell and Gales, there are chalk grassland or SSSI, so sites of special scientific interest, on each of those three farms, and they've always been managed almost bespokely by sort of grazing animals, managing the sward, keeping that biodiversity in there. In terms of the chalk grassland, we sort of really strongly believe that having animals in there, the right amount of animals, the right animals, and at the right time of year, is sort of key to managing those chalk grasslands and sort of keeping the sward at the correct level, nice and open, and sort of keeping the biodiversity and sort of species mix in there, and having different mows grow over at different times of the year also help that, because obviously cattle are a different type of grazer to sheep, and then we've got the goats that sort of are browsing and sort of going for the more woody shrub and scrub and sort of keeping those bushes down.
Is that like the cows and wrap the grass, long grasses around their tongue,
so
and pull them?
Yeah, they sort of tug and sort of rip it out. The sheep sort of really nibble down. They will focus on certain bits, and the goats just sort of, well, when they do their own thing, but when they're in the right place, they do sort of really keep that sort of a noticeable impact. And one thing we have up on just below the White Horse is Cotoneaster and tall grass. That's sort of two threats to the triple SI and sort of chalk grass in there. And they're really helping sort of keep on top of any of the Cotoneaster regrowth and sort of spread of that alongside the National Trust and us sort of doing selective sort of scrub control.
Like government payments for the protection of special environments and habitats have meant that people have continued doing this because there is, quite frankly, an incentive. Farmers are some of the worst paid workers, I think, within the food chain. And actually, in order to make their businesses work, to make their livelihoods possible, these environmental payments are really important. It does mean that not only do the farmers really care about this as guardians of our land, but they're also paid to take care of it. And the brilliant thing about it is it's super easy to conserve chalk grassland because all you really need to do is graze it. Of course, you can cut and collect it like you might do for hay, but actually the best thing is sending a variety of animals over it. Cows graze in a very different way from sheep, and goats graze in a different way again, and this variety of different animals going over the chalk grassland at the time of year when it's not flowering is really what helps to keep it healthy. It helps open up the sward and it allows the grassland plants to spread into new locations.
Can I jump in? I just know something interesting you said before. It was actually you saying about your sister studying at Edinburgh doing sustainability. Yeah. I guess maybe it'd be your sister that would answer this, not you, but like, I just wonder, how do you think she's finding it, that experience of like growing up coming from like a traditional like rural farming background and then going into a city to study sustainability?
Yeah.
I think people have quite, I guess like people who are studying sustainability in cities, they might be like vegetarians, vegans, they might be quite anti-meat. Like how is that, how do you think that is for your sister, like holding those two?
Does it
come up for her?
It definitely comes up. I know, so she's living with a vegetarian, also so somebody who doesn't eat meat. So, I mean, I think it's sort of a regular occurrence there, seeing what from our perspective, it's very much a sort of getting our side of what we're doing and why we're doing it out there. Because I think there's sort of a real negative stigma around farming as a whole and sort of picking on certain things and sort of saying that's wrong. And there's a lot of generalisation around.
They're not just the same rules for all, not all farms are the same, not all countries farming the same way, to the same specifications.
Exactly, and it's sort of, and like I was saying earlier, when we're looking at how we have our lambing pen set up and how we lamb, each farm does what suits their system the best and what sort of the topography is, what the weather is, it changes so much farm to farm, and so every farm does what suits that system best and what they can do, and that sort of generalising farming is a really sort of tricky thing because every farm is different and every county is different and sort of it definitely changes, and I think there's a real negative stigma around what farming is doing.
That's why we were like wanting to chat with you actually, because we were saying it before, like, we think farming is quite misunderstood, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like farmers can be
especially
very
meat farming,
yeah.
I think livestock farming.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so we sort of very strongly believe that sort of having a mixed farming business where each enterprise feeds into the other and supports the other is sort of a good sustainable way for us to move forward, both sort of from the environmental side but also economic, is having sort of, for instance, the sheep grazing our wheat crops to sort of cut down on using pesticides and herbicides and, or not herbicides, but pesticides and sort of growth regulators. And then you've got farming up and you're going on the field, so sort of natural organic fertilizer, and then in return you've got straw for bedding, feed, and the grain coming back, so it all sort of works together, and then you've got the rotation of different crops moving around the farm. It all feeds in together and works together for us here, and that's sort of what we're trying to push, is that you've got backup of the arable enterprise and grazing there, whereas if it gets really dry and you want to take the pressure off grazing sort of chalk grassland, then that's the priority, is getting the animals off there, because overgrazing that causes damage and you spend 5-10 years, because it's not a quick process of sort of improving grassland. Sort of it can be reversed very quickly if it's overgrazed or damaged. 1 year, sort of 5-10 years work can really be knocked back pretty significantly. So having that more productive pockets of grassland and sort of back up pastures is what we try and do, that work around the sensitive areas around the farm. So that's sort of what we try and push and keep it flexible. And that's really sort of the key, is having a flexible system that can handle abundant growth, but also drought years. We seem to be having sort of drier and drier springs and summers. Being able to handle, right, it's getting dry, we need to get the animals out of there and take them elsewhere, keep them away from those sensitive areas that will show damage if they're overgrazed.
There's actually quite a few farmers that do work in this way around Brighton and Hove. This is because it's a really traditional way to farm. Many families have been farming this land for hundreds of years, and there are so many people out in the Downs who are really keen on preserving this special landscape. People have been grazing the Downs for 4,500 years, and that continued creation of a managed landscape is why we have chalk grassland here. I think this is very much the conversation around wilding versus mass production of food. And nature is so important. Biodiversity is so important, not only from a preserving beauty and life point of view, but the fact that the majority of our pollinators are insects. If we don't have pollinators, we're not going to have any food. From a mental health point of view, we all know how good it feels to get out in nature and spend time walking on the Downs or even just sitting and looking at some trees. I mean, having said that, if we don't grow our own food in the UK, the reality is we will just be offshoring all of those negatives to another country. We know that nature is important, not just for protecting biodiversity, but also for ourselves. And in places where you can produce sustainable meat, it's really important to do that.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your relationship with the National Trust and the two sites that you graze for the National Trust?
Yeah, so at Frogfell, we've been tenants for the National Trust for just over 30 years now. So it's sort of been a really strong relationship over there. And sort of they've got a vision of how they want the farm to be looking and how we want to focus on certain areas each year, or over a 5-year process we want to look at improving certain areas of that farm, and we very much sort of are in line with what they're looking to do, and any management plans are sort of discussed and agreed, and sort of it's no, we want you to do this, go do it. It's sort of, there's a lot of collaboration there. And sort of long-term relationships between the farming team and the team at the National Trust, the rangers. So there's a really good relationship up there. And then the same process, the same rangers are up at Gales. Slightly different because that's now in the Changing Chalk project. So what was arable has now gone into a sort of herbal lay pasture.
Tell us about the special Gales Farm runway.
Yeah, so in World War II, there were two runways up on, well, just above Friston Forest. I believe one was a bomber runway and the other was an emergency runway. It's the glorious place to be. And when it was in arable, there were two runways that were not quite in the right place. And so I think when they were put in, they were one was a nectar-rich plot. And the other was a birdseed plot, which ran nearly a kilometre long, just not quite in the right place, which I think was down to operator error rather than doing it on purpose. And then since then, so changing, Gales Farm entered into the Changing Chalk project in 22, I believe. And so the runways were reinstated exactly where they were in World War II in wildflower meadows. And then around the runways is a 20 species herbal lay, which has been grazed by sheep, grazed by cattle, and then we cut some for silage and haylage. So, sort of 18 months into that rotation, and it's going well. Sort of really real range of species in the lays.
Some of the animals that have been grazing on that land have been going into the Sussex grazed meat box scheme, is that
right? Yes. So the animals were up there, so they were April-born lambs and using lambs. I say they graze the herbal lay through the spring and summer. The ewes then went on to the Triple SI up at Gales. So they've really, well, those animals are sort of entirely chalked, rather than being chalk grassed and fed, or chalk, changing chalk sort of throughout the entire process, which is a nice sort of full circle of where it's coming and going from. And sort of entirely grass-fed animals that are sort of doing an important role in the landscape of managing sort of those important habitats, and at the same time.
It's quite complicated, actually, the models that you have and how they all interconnect, because you've got, you tell me how it works, but you've got these payments that come from the National Trust for the grazing, and then do you have subsidies that come in as well?
So farming sort of going through a period of change away from land-based payments, so it was basic payment schemes, what it was called, so that's being phased out in 2028. So what we used to get paid for was just the area of land you farmed, you'd get paid a set amount for that area, which for a sort of extensive farm like ourselves was really important. It was an important income stream. Admittedly, I think everyone sort of will agree, or not agree, but sort of generally I think the feeling is it wasn't perfect, but it was a good way of propping up small family businesses that were trying to do the right thing, didn't have the scale, didn't have the investment to really drive it forward. It was keeping that going. That's now being phased out, and what's being replaced is countryside stewardship, which is another form of subsidy where you enter into an agreement which you do land-based actions, and you'll be paid accordingly to it. If it's, say, leaving buffer strips in fields or margins, sort of leaving space for nature, which, yes, you're taking out of, say, arable production, but you're getting paid to do that so that it's worthwhile. Because otherwise, when things are so tight, leaving land that you're not producing anything on but not getting paid for it, it sort of seems mad. So sort of having that buffer to make up for sort of space for nature is what that sort of subsidy is around, I guess. And then there's SFI, Sustainable Farming Incentive, which is just coming in. And again, similar to countryside stewardship, paying farmers to leave areas of land or do different practices which may not be as productive but are better for biodiversity or soil or air or nature, whatever it is. There's sort of a wide range of options or activities you can do, and that's what that is for, is you're getting paid to not produce food in, say, the conventional way. It's twisting it a little bit, and then yeah, so the farms up at Gales, Frogfell, Clapham, being able to graze those flexibly. And then you asked how the sort of three farms link together, is if one farm has been sort of, we grazed the herbal layout, sort of we've done the rotational grazing there, it's starting to get dry, okay, we need to move them elsewhere. If they weren't linked and the farms were completely separate, then there's nowhere else to move them. You've still got those animals on that ground, but there's then risk of sort of overgrazing or damaging what's there. So being able to have another farm or another area you can take those animals away from that won't do any damage to, or if it's the chalk grass and if it's the herbal lay, you've sort of got that flexibility. So I guess that's how the sort of three farms really link, is that you can get the animals there, but when they've done their job, they've done their grazing, you can't just click your fingers and they disappear. They've got to go somewhere else. And that's sort of the key thing of how the three farms link together.
And what does it take you to get those animals into the local food system? I know that part of the reason you're working with Laura on Sussex Graze is to try and get some meat that's like grown more locally to people around the down.
This comes back to the nationalisation, or actually internationalisation, of food systems. Sort of through necessity, farmers have gone down the route of feeding into a national food chain, especially when we talk about meat. This is because local infrastructure has all but been removed. For the moment in Sussex, for example, we only have one small local abattoir, which means that they really struggle to take in all the animals that farmers want to provide into the local food system. And this forces farmers to send their animals much further afield, over to Guildford or even down to Devon, in order to be slaughtered and to enter the food system. So I think the biggest difficulty and one of the really useful things that Sussex Grazed has highlighted is that local food infrastructure doesn't exist in the way that we need it to anymore. So not only do you need to find a farmer who wants to do all of that extra work that it takes to feed an animal into a local food system, but you then have to jump through all the hoops in order to get those animals in a condition that means that people can eat them. Of course, that's also added to by the fact that people rightly are used to shopping in supermarkets. You know, most of us work really long hours. None of us have a lot of time to go to multiple shops to get our food in. So, of course, we rightly go for the most convenient option. Unfortunately, though, this has led to the dismantling of local food systems and therefore increasingly makes it more and more difficult to get hold of local food.
So yeah, like I said, most of our animals go through one of the big processes, and then we do obviously Sussex Grazed, and so that's our second share just coming up, and then we've always sort of tried to do a few private sales, advertised locally, and trying to sort of get some sort of customer base up in the local community, and that's really either through word of mouth or a bit of social media. But it's tricky. It's really tricky to try and, one, get the word out there when you've got 101 different things going on, and two, you want to make it affordable. It's sort of, although it's a good product you're selling, it's sort of the margins are tight regardless, and sort of you want everyone to win. You want to be able to sell a good product at a good price that's fair for everyone. At the same time, you need to make sure that you're making some margin out of it as well. So that's one really sort of tricky thing is finding a happy balance there where everyone wins, so to speak. But also then the next challenge is local abattoirs are closing by the day. So we used to have Tottingworth, which is about half an hour from here. That's closed last year, I believe, beginning of last year. And that's where we used to send all our animals to. Now, Henfield is sort of the next nearest option, which is 45 minutes away. But one, it's trying to get a slot in there because you've now got all these local farmers trying to sell or get animals processed through one site. And the sort of the options become less and less available to you. And it's sort of, how do you put forward plan 6 months in advance? Because that's when you've got a slot, right? You've got to get an animal ready for them. Okay, what if the weather's been miserable like it has been? It's not nearly as flexible as it used to be.
Yeah, I think that's something that lots of people don't understand. Like, certainly I didn't realise until Laura told me that, like, I guess people don't have a sense of the whole infrastructure that's needed beyond just, like, rearing a lamb or something. There's then the part where you take it to an abattoir and then, like, yeah, there's so many more steps involved.
Yeah, and then sort of the ageing process and then having a butcher who can deliver it to you or get it all sorted in time, and it's sort of, there's so many different people in the process who all, again, need to be able to make a cut out of it to stay profitable and operating.
Could you maybe just talk us through, like, what, like, the steps that are involved in that process, say, from, like, an animal leaving your farm to then,
The goat's quite a good one, because you don't sell the goats at the moment into the national market, so they're quite small flocks.
Yeah, no, so the goats, we started our flock, while we were still unsure what a goat herd flock trip is actually supposed to be called, so we'll go with flock for now, but we'll herd. So we started the herd in 2021, so we bought 15, and then bought a few, sort of another 30, a couple of months after that, with the intention of having an animal that can really target specific sort of scrubby species up on steep banks that other animals are not interested in at all.
They're a bit more nimble
and they're browsers rather than grazers, supposedly, so they will prefer to eat what's at head height rather than what's on the floor. So that was our thinking there, is having another mouth in the system, another sort of tool in the box, well, grazing box that can target different species at a different time and sort of help manage the landscape, I guess. And so what we did was brought these boar goats up to 50 now, just kidding at the moment. And they are then being fed in. We've had a few through Sussex Grazed, and then we've sold a few locally just through private sales. And I think goat has got a really bad reputation for being tough and just sticking a curry. That's all you can do with it. It's sort of old tough goat sticking in a curry.
It wasn't tough. It was absolutely delicious.
And yeah, sort of it's a really beautiful product, which is sort of entirely sort of grazed on the downs. But again, really tricky to sort of one find a market for them. All we're only selling privately. Sort of approached a few restaurants and stuff and say, well, would you be interested? And they say yes, but I don't think we can reliably supply a restaurant that wants sort of this amount on this date, only these cuts. It's not flexible, and that's sort of what we need. Is we need carcass balance. It's great being able to sell a fillet or a loin or a leg, great, but what do you do with the rest of the animal?
Which is
minced or diced or whatever it is, which is what makes up a lot of an animal.
Which is why selling by quarter means you get this range of cuts and you take the whole carcass.
Yeah, and
account.
That's sort of really important. I think also really important from a consumer level is understanding that, yes, it's nice to have a steak at the end of the day, but also there's sort of that balance of understanding that a lot of an animal will end up as mince or sort of a slightly less, you'd say, desirable cut, but it's not desirable, it's just
something that needs a little bit more attention,
yeah,
and a little bit more work or longer
cooking. And maybe it's that sort of people nowadays are so busy they don't want to cook, they want to have stuff on the move and convenience,
and just education
yeah,
of
education
knowing how to deal with the cuts that are
yeah.
slightly more unusual perhaps.
Yeah no, absolutely. And again, I think that's what you're doing. So you're doing these cookery classes and the sort of evenings of showing people how to break down different things and how to cook different cuts that they're not used to eating. And that's sort of another really important thing, is understanding that eating seasonally, but also sort of eating different cuts and cooking them in a different way, because there are 100 different ways of eating the same piece of meat, I guess, but there's only one or two right ways, you'd say. But an animal, they're so diverse that you've got a range of different cuts that are completely different to eat and cook at different times of the year, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's sort of having that way of getting rid of the entire animal.
So talk us through, so what would you do then if you're going to take them to get them prepared to be able to be sold?
They are, and they're a real pain actually sometimes, but we love them most of the time.
When I came to visit the goats, there was a bit of a stink, wasn't there? When was that I came to visit and they were in?
That would have been, was that October, November time, I think.
Yeah, stinky buck.
And that was, yeah, so we had a buck in there called Ian, who is lovely temperament, but they're smelly. Real.
Why are they smelly?
So the for some unbeknownst reason, the buck decides that they need to urinate on themselves to spread the scent.
You can literally smell it from across
it's
the field.
It's quite potent.
Wow.
It's really quite potent, and you can't get away from it. And you don't really want to get anywhere near him when he's in that mood, because one, he's a bit protective over his girls, and two, he honks. So we do weigh all our animals quite regularly, and that's really to keep on top of if there are any problems. You can, one pretty obvious way of seeing if there's a problem, even if it's not visible, is that they'll either not be gaining weight as much as you'd expect or losing weight. So we weigh quite regularly. But when we're sort of selecting animals for slaughter, it's weigh them. You have a rough idea of how much they'll weigh as a sort of carcass, as sort of a meat product. After that, we'll sort of check their body condition, so sort of fat cover on their backs, and make sure that there's actually something there, because you don't want too lean a meat, because it's not particularly good eating. From there, it's all booked into the abattoir, load them up, sort of all the licenses, so it's sort of fully traceable. Every animal that comes onto the farm, leaves the farm, has its own individual identity, which is fully traceable throughout the system. That's the same with supermarkets. So on each packet of meat, there's where the animal was killed, when it was killed, and at what site. And then from there, you can, it's fully traceable back to the farm of origin. Transported to, so for us would be Henfield. A specific slot goes in there, and then either they deliver back to our butcher for a little bit of aging. So for a lamb, we'll try and hang for a week. Heifers or our cattle will maybe try and hang for a bit longer, 21 days, 28 days. Butchered, delivered back here, and then we try and distribute to the customers, which, as Laura knows, it's sort of quite stressful when boxes of meat come back and it's like, right, we need to organise it all, who's going where, who's collecting when. There's always someone who doesn't turn up, or something doesn't quite go to plan, or...
Yeah, that seems to be the bane of your life in the office. I feel like I constantly hear you just trying to work out a place for people to collect boxes. I feel like it's a good example, though, as like a microcosm of just like what you actually need to get food out to somebody. Like, there's so many more steps.
There are, and I think from a farming perspective, that there is so much work that goes into getting the animal to the point of being ready to be sold for meat, that then to have to do an entirely new job of going through that process, I mean, that takes you, it takes you half a day probably to out of your time on the farm to get it to the abattoir and be waiting for the animals to be loaded in, and then transporting from the butcher or getting original delivery for that, like advertising to people locally. It's entirely separate.
At this point in the conversation, which we'd been having in Ed's parents' lovely homely kitchen, Ed's dad walked in, who has been a farmer all his life on the South Downs. So we just thought we'd keep this bit of conversation in that we shared with him, because he had some nice insights to share on his thoughts about being a Downland farmer.
Good for you. Well, anything that makes people interested in food and how they eat it and where it comes from is good. Food's important. You have got a fantastic opportunity with there being so much farmland, so close to Brighton, and it's right on your doorstep. Fantastic resource for people to go and enjoy, but it's good for them to understand that food's an important part of the landscape and what it's all about.
So the Land Use Plus project that Laura mentioned, I might just be saying this wrong, so you might have to correct me. But
yeah, it's not hard and fast. It's just looking at the idea of what it would take for farmers who are because a lot of the farmers that I speak to locally do sell into the national market and don't do direct meat sales. It's really, really hard to find people who are actually doing that, it seems, and using that local system and that local infrastructure, however broken it is. But what it might take to, rather than trying to convert the whole system across into the local system rather than the national system, what would it take for you to redirect like 20% of what was going into the national market into the local market, and how realistic do you think that is for farmers locally to do that?
I mean, I think we're as producers entirely reliant on what the consumer wants. I mean, if there's a consumer base out there but large enough, then I don't think it would be a huge step to be able to supply that. I mean, like I said, the one sort of bottleneck around here, and I guess it's almost nationally as well, is the lack of local abattoirs. And I mean, all these other big abattoirs are aligned to individual processors, and they really don't want to have the faff of individual animals coming in, handled differently, and then stored separately. And they don't want it. It's not worth the time and effort when it's all about scale and efficiency, and for them it's about getting sort of the economies of scale, getting the amount of animals through to keep it all operating and running smoothly. So down here I think it's the main bottleneck is that local processing capacity, because I think there are consumers here who want locally grown, locally reared, whatever it is, food, but it's having it's having sort of being able to supply that
And what is
distributed actually, because obviously you're handling a fresh product that needs to be stored and handled incredibly carefully at the risk of any sort of contamination, and so having the infrastructure there of being able to have cold storage or aging storage that you can allow an animal to hang there for however long you want to age it for, without one getting in the way or getting contaminated, and again having that infrastructure to be able to do that,
how much do you worry about and do you talk to other farmers about, are they worried about what will happen? I mean, I know that the local abattoir is on a site that's been bought by housing
development.
It's been bought by Barclay Homes, so they've run they've got a short tenancy left there now. They've only got 7 years left on that site. They can't expand, they can't move at the moment,
no.
And they're already over capacity.
Yeah.
So what happens in 7 years' time when that's not there anymore? What is the impact on local farmers, and how much concern is there in the local farming community?
It's a big concern, because although the private sales take up a small share of the total, they're still an important channel for animals that wouldn't fit the specification of what the supermarkets want. And also it's sort of damaging that local food system of locally grown, staying local, the food, minimising food miles. I think along with sort of the challenge of the abattoirs, actually sort of livestock markets are really threatened. So for our local one is Hailsham, which I don't know, it's been there, sort of a really old traditional market that's been there for God knows how long, but a long time. It's a lovely traditional market, but it's in the middle of Hailsham now. It's not well located anymore because the town's grown, and there's a real threat to Hailsham market, and they'd like to relocate, but that's come under a lot of sort of public opposition, which is probably not entirely sort of educated opposition. It's more just I don't want that there because I don't understand what it is, but I think it's bad. But having those local markets is again a real lifeline for livestock farmers in the area, because there are a lot of animals. Say if we've got some old ewes that we don't want to keep for breeding next year, the retailers don't want them. There's absolutely zero interest from them. Where's your sales outlet? Because there are traders or buyers who will buy them either to breed from, or they'll have their own individual customer base, be it sort of food shops or kebab shops or whatever it is, which we can't access, but you've got bigger buyers who can.
And presumably the local abattoir and the local mart, they support the rare breeds, presumably, that the supermarkets might not take either.
Yeah, so there's a real channel and challenge to livestock markets that is sort of underappreciated, and not only that, sort of there's the amount of animals being traded between farms. It's an important sort of source of revenue for say we're lucky enough to have barns and have space to be able to finish animals inside if we needed to or if the weather changed, whereas a lot of farms, they don't have that shed space, and if they can't sell through the market, they can't sell store animals.
There's a lot of culture.
They're really limited at where they can go, and like I said, the cultural importance of livestock markets is sort of shouldn't be ignored.
And the community, because that's where the farming community gathers and talks to each other and shares concerns.
Yeah, news spreads through markets.
They used to share songs. That's how you used to pick up songs through the livestock markets and
did
the sheep fairs and things.
A folk musician. I didn't know this. Laura's brilliant.
I've got quite a lot of sheep songs. I could probably throw in a sheep song somewhere.
Perfect for this time of year then. Sing to the lambs up in the shed.
That's it.
I think I'll spare them.
Yeah. The next time there's a share, you can sing everyone a song as they're coming in.
And also having that community and that. So the community spirit in the markets is important for sort of the farmer's mental health. I mean, there's a huge sort of yellow wellies doing, they're really doing an amazing job at spreading the noise about the fact that farming is sort of, it's a lonely job, and people don't want to talk about their problems, or their challenges, and it's sort of getting people out and about and having that community and those conversations is really important. And yellow wellies spread the sort of mental health awareness really well.
Okay, yellow wellies is the farming mental health
organisation. Yeah, so they do a fantastic job, but it's something that's really sort of not thought about, and generally farmers, they don't want to talk about their feelings. They don't want to do that. But being able to go to market, have a chat with your sort of friend of 40, 50 years, whatever it is.
Do you think that's improving as that's going down the generations? Do you think that things are better with your generation?
I think younger generations do talk a bit more about how they feel and what they're sort of, they've got social media to, I guess, one, help, but it's probably also a massive hindrance in the fact that you see what someone else has got and their life looks so much better than yours, and you sort of see that, but also it's an opportunity to sort of share your story and your what's going on. So I think it's sort of, yes, better, but also there's real challenges there. Mental health is sort of a real challenge to farmers who, long hours in miserable wet weather half the time, and there's risk of not seeing a huge amount of people, and sometimes you can't, you can do everything right, but everything will go wrong because it's not you can't control the weather, you can't control other things, you can't control the soil, you can't, so you're working with things and sometimes everything goes against you.
That's exactly what I was going to say, it's about lack of control in that, and especially with the fact that it's a subsidised industry as well, and that you're at the whims of the supermarkets and the
and
the industry.
And you see all these things on sort of getting battered by social media or news reports about sort of the woes of farming. You think, well, it's not quite how it's being portrayed, but you haven't got a voice there. And I guess it's a real challenge, is that a lot of people feel cornered and there's nowhere for them to go, and I think that's sort of where Yellow Wellies is doing a really good job at raising mental health awareness and getting people talking about what is going on.
Yeah, I think it's a really good good point to end on as well, because I think from my perspective, my limited time working in this field, is that we're really reliant on you as farmers to not only provide us with food, but also we're in your hands with making environmental, as being resilient to weather, what's coming to us with climate change. And
yeah, I was thinking that it felt like poignant that you were talking about how the subsidy structure is changing, and it's like a stewardship structure now, and I was like, that's quite a loaded word, stewardship.
Yeah.
Like, I think it signifies that, like, you're doing a lot, like, farmers are doing a lot for, like,
stewards of the land.
And stewarding land, and I think that's something that isn't always seen.
Try to do what we do in the best way we can do it. That's what you can really do, I guess, for us at least. And love what you do, really. That's what we try and do.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Savouring Change with me, Ruth Smart, my colleagues, Laura Hockenhull and Sophie Robinson, and of course with Ed Brown, the tenant downland farmer that we've been chatting to in this episode. If you want to find out more about our Sussex Grazed scheme, or conservation grazing in general, be sure to head over to our website and look up Sussex Grazed, where you can find out more about the work we're doing in and around the South Downs.